Welcome to the second part of the third class of Britain since the Romans. And we're going to look at the Industrial Revolution and Empire, 1700 to 1914. Okay, all of that. Now, this is important. Well, I mean, teachers always say that what they're going to say is important because, you know, they think it will make you listen. But if it hadn't been for the Empire, you would probably be here learning Spanish or something else, which is easier to pronounce. So I apologize about that. The Industrial Revolution of the Empire. Now, Britain was the first country to have an Industrial Revolution, and it's a great advantage of being the first. It's like, you know, if you're in a very hostile situation and you're the first person to get a gun, that's enough, you know, if you're first. And because Britain had the first Industrial Revolution, then they also had the first postal service, the first railways. And around the world, everybody asked the British to come and build their railways. The Argentinian railways were built by the British, even though it was not a British colony. So that was something that was tremendously important. So why did the... As you know, the historians always prefer the question, why? And so we're tempted with the question, why was Britain the first to have Industrial Revolution? Well, certainly... there was the geography helps. It's never very far to the sea, and so to build canals, which were tremendously important for the first Industrial Revolution, was much easier in Britain than in France. And indeed, poor old Riquet in France worked very hard building the Canal du Midi, which is lovely, but it was a lot further than the canals in Britain. Secondly, because it was an island, they very quickly had the best ships. This is quite simple. If you have coal in the north of England, or if you have wool in Scotland, the quickest way to go to London is by ship. Now, of course, today the quickest way is to go down the motorway. But spoiler, there were no motorways. So ships were by far the fastest way to go anywhere, and so the geography of Britain helped it to be first. Secondly, the shipbuilding and mercantile power meant that it had very quickly a large empire, which gave it the money to invest in industry, including a huge amount of money that came from slavery, something which has been more studied recently. Perhaps you're aware that the history of slavery has been much more studied over the last 20 years, and indeed in France and in Britain they have opened museums about slavery. I think the first one was in 2002 or something. So we can't say that anybody was in a great hurry, but now there is a museum in Bordeaux and one in Liverpool. Now, when we look at the Industrial Revolution, it's really an expression which is a bit of a shorthand, the Industrial Revolution. In fact, it was a whole series of revolutions. You can't have one without the other. So let's look at them in order. First of all, the Agricultural Revolution. The old way of organizing land was transformed slowly over a few centuries by a reform that we call the enclosures, and it's a very simple idea, really. In the old form, you have a kind of picture of this. No, not yet. In the old form, that you have the village, and around it you have three big fields, because you mustn't use the fields all the time, and so you have one field which is empty this year, and then another field growing one crop, and another field growing another crop, and each family in the village have a little bit of that field and a little bit of this field. It's the strip system. And then there's quite a lot of common land which people use because they don't grow things on it. They get firewood. Firewood, extremely important just to stay alive. Rabbits, you know, whatever. And the enclosures is when land becomes more profitable, the elite starts, oh, this common land, well. In fact, kind of in theory, everything belongs to the king. And the king starts, oh yeah, this common land here, we're enclosing it, and it now belongs to the Duke of Manchester. And a lot of the peasants. So somebody, but I live there. I use it. That's what I use to get alive. So can you show me the documents that prove that you are the owner of this land? And the document. What's a document? Yeah. So you know, the modern society crushed the old way of doing things. Now, this privatization of common land had good points and bad points. The bad points was we always talk about how the peasants were forced to go to the towns to get jobs, and this helped industry. To be strictly correct, half of them died, and then the other half went to the towns. It was pretty rough time. However, it did mean that the agriculture was more efficient, because the new landowners had big tracts of lands and not one strip here and one strip there. Then they used the latest technology. The latest technology at the time was not mobile phones, but it was irrigation. I don't know how much agriculture you know about, probably more than me, because I know the French are mostly peasants, aren't they? That's what they told me. So agriculture is really, you can produce three or four times more on the same land if you have good irrigation. And secondly, technology like metal ploughs instead of wooden ploughs. I don't know when was the last time you ploughed a field with a wooden plough. It's hard. Yeah, better with a. Number two, the transport revolution. Now, the transport revolution is tremendously important. I'm talking here about the 18th and 19th century. Quite a long period. Now, the transport revolution is essential, because if you don't have transport, you can't have an industrial revolution. In the old society, if you live in a village and you make chairs, and every week you can make 5 chairs. And you're quite pleased, because you sell three chairs a week in this village and 3 chairs a week around the place. And then somebody comes along and says, "Hey, I've got a new technology. You can make 100 chairs a week." And the chair maker says, "No, thank you. I can't do anything with 100 chairs. There's no transport to go further to the big towns. I can't do it." So without transport, the Industrial Revolution is impossible, because it just doesn't give you the... and indeed, at the time, the roads were extremely bad. We're in London. I'm going to Scotland. Ah, when will you arrive in Scotland? Perhaps Tuesday after next. Yeah, it was really a tremendously long time to go there. And one of the big reforms which made transport better was the Turnpike Trust. The Turnpike, it's only Béage. Now, the difficulty that they had with the roads is that the roads were the responsibility of the local village, but they tended to repair the roads just for a couple of miles, and then the rest of it was very bad. The turnpike roads meant you had to pay to go on the roads, but that meant they actually repaired the roads. So the turnpike trusts were set up, private companies who were authorized by the government to take money for going on the roads and to build decent roads. And the very first turnpike trust was in 1707. So the very first road, which was privatised, but therefore became a real road, is 1707, and it rises very, very, very slowly. By 1830, there are over 1,000 companies administering 30,000 miles of turnpike road. 30,000 miles in England and Wales. And there are 8,000 toll gates. Yeah, we mean péage. So that's the first element of the transport revolution, is the turnpike roads, the privatisation of roads. Again, it's not much fun if you're a peasant and you don't have any money to pay the toll. But the time needed to go from London to Scotland was reduced by 10 times or something, which is something absolutely huge, something absolutely massive. The second moment of the transport revolution begins around 1760. Anybody got an idea? The railways? Not yet. Before the railways. I know it's not so easy to think about these things, because it's not really your area, but I remember asking students, which came first, the canals or the railways? How many people, put your hand up if you think the canals came first. Put your hand up if you think the railways came first. Okay. Yeah, you did better than most groups, actually. Yeah, the thing is that, if I ask you to build a canal or a railway for 10 kilometres, which one are you going to choose? A railway. The canals are really, really hard work, and water is a horrific thing that keeps going places you don't want it to go. So railways are 100 times easier to build than canals. And so if they knew how to build railways, they wouldn't be able to build any canals, in fact. The canals. And so here we have the canals, the canal revolution from 1760 onwards. And its heyday is 1760 to 1830, because after 1830 the railways were pretty good. Relatively pretty good. It's kind of strange to look back to a time when England had the best railways in Europe, when today they have the worst railways in Europe. But there you go. What can you do? This is why we like to talk about the empire. We used to be good at stuff, the English. As you can see, here are the horses pulling the canals, and the economics of it is very simple. If you imagine the same horse pulling a cart on wheels, it obviously cannot pull as much weight. Tremendous. So it's very, very expensive to build canals. And they were built in the traditional capitalist way. That is, that they began 20 canals and 10 of them were abandoned because they ran out of money. You know, it's a competition. The two companies building canals in the same place. It's just a wild competition. It was not nationalised or anything. But nevertheless, the result was you eventually got pretty good canals. And Britain had the great advantage: it's not very far to the sea. It's never very far to the sea. And so this is obviously a tremendous advantage. Much of the canals were built by Irish workers. Ireland was very poor, and quite often, but also not, it's a long way, but it's not so far. And so you would quite often get Irish workers coming over and working on the canals, and then going back to Ireland what's it called when you get all the stuff out of the ground? The harvest, for the harvest.
The seasonal workers.
Yeah, seasonal workers. Absolutely, that's exactly the word. Now, after 1830, I'm not going to give you, in fact, the dates. Very often in history books, you see the dates of the invention, the first train, which is very interesting. But of course, the first train didn't go anywhere or do anything. So I'm more talking about when it became practicable. And from 1830 on, you have the railways, and indeed there was a big railway mania in the 1840s, which was a speculative frenzy when huge numbers of railway companies were set up. The proposed routes, at one point 272 Acts of Parliament were passed in the same year, setting up new railway companies. And the proposed routes totaled 9,500 miles of new railways. Yeah, about a third of the railways were never built. So it was all pretty chaotic, but nevertheless, the result was you had railways at the end of it. Now, again, because Britain had the first industrial revolution and the first transport revolution, they also were first in other things as well. This is a tremendous invention. It's only very small, but in fact it's a really clever idea, because it's just simply a postage stamp where you pay first. You remember letters, yeah? Because I know you're a different generation now. You pay first, and then you put the stamp. I'm being silly. And then you put the stamp and you send it. So first of all, you pay first, so the transport company is reassured. And secondly, it's the same price wherever your letter is going. So that makes the administration within the country. That makes the administration first. So here's the first, the penny black, the first ever postage stamp. So somebody actually had the... Now, postage stamps are pretty simple things, but when they've never existed, inventing the idea is really pretty difficult. Your new ideas are difficult to get. So the first postage stamp. Before this, it was much more complicated. You used to send the letter, and the person who received the letter would pay if they wanted to. And what they used to do is this: you say, "Oh, I want an answer from you. Yeah, you're going home. I want an answer from you next week. Send me a letter. And if your answer is yes, write Mullen John with my address. And if your answer is no, write John Mullen." And so they came down. Here's a letter for you. So, "Oh no, I don't want the letter. Thank you." Yeah, just do codes and stuff, because people are clever like that. And so the communication revolution then is the other thing I wanted to talk about there. And the first element is the postal, 1840. And then the telegraph, So the telegraph is a cable, comes along with the railways because they realise that it's relatively easy to run a cable above a railway, and then you have the information, you know, with Morse code, etc. And this is an amazing moment. Where is this? Where are we? The lion, this dome. This is London. This is London. It's strange because it's the other way around usually. And this is New York. Yeah, New York. The American Eagle. This is probably St. Patrick's Cathedral. We're used to seeing it the other way around. And this is the first transatlantic telegraph cable. The first transatlantic telegraph cable. 1866. And as you can see in this picture, they're pretty proud of it, and you can imagine why, because previously, you come into your gentleman's club in London, if you're a gentleman, and then you say, hey, I've got the latest news from New York. 2 weeks ago, this happened. Yeah, that was the news before this cable, and suddenly you had today's news today, which was really something very impressive. Yeah, today's news today. Okay, so let's move on to the actual industry then. And as I'm sure you know, this is just near to where I. Where I used to live when I was a child. It's a cotton mill. It's a cotton mill, and I'm sure you know that textiles were at the centre of the question of the Industrial Revolution. Before the Industrial Revolution in Britain, India was the place for textiles. It was the best textiles in the world, and the British elites imported textiles from India. But of course, they were for the elites. And the mass production of cotton by slaves in the United States, transformed in Britain in these huge new factories, will transform the world. Not least because cotton is really cool. Cotton is cool because it's easy to wash. It's cheap compared with the previous ones. And this meant that people lived a lot longer because they began changing their clothes. And if you want to live a long time, changing your clothes is good. So just to remind you, if any of you have any doubts about this. So cotton, coal employed over 1 million people in 1840, including many thousands of children. And this slowly caused a certain amount of scandal, partly because there were so many children dying in the factories, that the elite were beginning to worry that they weren't going to have any workers anymore, and also a certain amount of organization of workers demanding better conditions led to a few basic laws to slightly improve the conditions. And here are some of the very, very important moments. The Mines Act of 1842 was an act of Parliament passed in Great Britain in 1842, which was a response to the working conditions of children revealed in the and in 1842 reports. This act said that people working underground must be older than, would you like to guess? Yeah. 10. She was right, yeah, 10, older than 10. So after 1842, Britain was a very advanced country which didn't allow children under 10 to work underground in the mines. Finalement, vous savez, l'université, aller à la fac à Rouen, c'est pas si dur, hein? On exagère des fois. This is girls and boys as well, and indeed the report showed that they were children at work, 5 and 6 years old, were working underground, and so this was the law that involved. The 1844 Factory Act reduced the working. It was a big change. It reduced the working day for children. It said no work for children under nine, and that the employers must teach children to read and write. So from 1844, they reduced the working day for children to 6.5 hours with school in the morning. So notice what you have here is absolutely not the idea that the government is responsible for education like we have today. It's not about, yeah, it's better if they can read and write. Their employer is obliged to teach them to read and write in the good old-fashioned way. You'd beat them until they read and write, yeah? Ah, those were the good old days. Or not. So these were... and gradually, there are more factory acts, which are partly under the pressure of the fact that factory owners needed their workers not to die too much. And also because radical movements such as the Chartists and then the mass trade unions, the Chartists in the 1830s to 1850s, and the mass trade unions after 1870, put pressure on. So it's a mixture of the two things. So I don't want to give you details. So little by little, there were limitations on the on these. Yes. So I have a list of all of them here. Yeah, after 1850, the work week for adults was 60 hours. Yeah. After 1856, Saturday afternoon was declared to be part of the weekend. And the reason that football games are played on a Saturday afternoon is because of this. The Factory Act in 1878 said women must not work more than 56 hours a week. Ha! Privilege. Okay. And after 1891, children can only work from the age of 11. So all of these changes, then the increase in the invention of the factory, rationalisation of agriculture, and the privatisation of common land, meant that urbanisation was accelerated, and Britain became the most urban country in the world. And this is something you still see today. That if I ask you, how many people have grandparents who were farmers or in agriculture? Okay. Now, if I ask this question in England, I never get anybody saying yes, because the English peasantry disappeared in 1850, and indeed 1850 is the moment in Britain when half the population lives in the towns. 1850, you have half the population in the towns. The equivalent date in France is sometime in the 1930s. And indeed, we saw this in the First World War. Well, I saw this in the First World War, not personally. I mean, in the history books. That in the First World War, the British Army was an army of factory workers, and the French Army was an army of peasants. It was just a completely different thingy, which also had all sorts of other changes as well, because it was because of village life that in France you got the conflict with the church, and therefore the invention of laïcité. Which never happened in Britain. As you can imagine, these towns in 1830, 1840, 1850, there was tremendous poverty and overcrowding, and of course, if you were unemployed, then you did not receive any money. The only welfare after 1834, the new poor law in 1834, the only welfare was the workhouse. And the workhouse was very, very simple. If you had no money at all, you could go to the workhouse and you had to work, but you received food and lodging. However, they separated families, they separated men from their wives, they separated them from their children, because the official written theory was life in the workhouse must be worse than any job outside the workhouse. Bien sûr, il y avait de la marge. This was really because the elite considered that people only work because you make them work, and so if you could live in the workhouse even as well as the worst job outside, then people would prefer to go to the workhouse. The workhouses existed until the First World War. And people did not look in great shape. This is so this is later, because you've got a photograph, so it must be at least the 1850s or 1860s, and you can see that they're not looking great. The other thing is that the workhouses were also, you know, if you're unemployed or mentally handicapped or disabled, well, it's all the same thing really, isn't it? You can't work. And so they were horrible places. These huge buildings often later became hospitals, but that we had a problem with these hospitals because they were remembered as such a horrible place that many working class people refused to go to the hospital because it was the place their grandmother had died in horrible circumstances, and so on and so forth. Even my grandmother hated going to the hospital because it was the place where the workhouse had been. Now, of course, there was plenty of if you have the first industrial revolution in the world, you also have the first trade union movement in the world. It's automatic. Because the Industrial Revolution brings together huge numbers of workers, and you know, quite often they just suffer, but every now and then they organise and resist as well. And so so Britain becomes the place of the very first trade union movement. So now the trade unions have changed a lot as the years went by. The very first trade unions go back a lot further. Even in the 17th century, you have trade unions. But the original trade unions are what we call craft unions. For example, stonemasons, that's the best example I can think of, the stonemasons or carpenters. They would have a trade union, which would be really much more a social organisation, where you are allowed in after a 7-year apprenticeship. And I know that in France you have this amazing thing where you had to travel around the country for a year as a carpenter or as a builder to introduce yourself to everybody. They had their secret oaths and their secret handshakes and the sort of mix between a Freemason society and but they were only for the best paid workers. Now, the best paid workers were not very well paid, but they were never hungry. The second set of trade unions were the general unions for all kinds of workers. And this is one of the leaders, Robert Owen, 1771 to 1858. Here's a statue of him in front of a modern statue of him, and you can see the image that he has. Yeah, that here he is, obviously somebody from the elite. You can tell by, and he looks after the poor children. That's the image he had. And he was he had a lot of ideas about how society could be changed, which were basically social Christian ideas. And he established the General Union of Workers. But the trade unions had to be invented. And today we know what a trade union is. You know, that what do trade unions do? They try to get the largest number of members, they negotiate a lot, and they sometimes strike. That's the basic. But this had to be invented. This was not the original idea. The original idea of trade unions, people would debate, well, what is a trade union for? I know what we should do. We should set up our own company and employ people so that we can treat people better than the employers do. So let's move up. Let's be a space where we can, and this is kind of workers' cooperatives. That was one idea. Other people said, no. What a trade union should do is campaign for change in society. So we need trade union members of parliament, or we need new ideas for how to revolutionize society. It took a long time before trade unions in the modern sense were set up. And indeed, the key moment is probably 1880s, when for the first time in Britain, trade unions were set up for everybody. That is to say, for people who did not have a long apprenticeship. The dockers, for example. At the time, if you're a docker today, you need to be able to use computers and cranes and stuff. But at the time, you just had to carry stuff, you know. There were no containers. Containers are an incredible reform, where you get a container. They're all the same size, and they could be full of bananas or computers. It doesn't matter. But that was in the 1980s or 1990s. This is just everything being carried. You need a certain amount of skill, or you put all the heavy things on one side, and the ship turns over. Be careful. So the Dockers' Union One of the great strikes which encouraged the formation of unions is the Match Girls strike of 1888. Now the Match Girls, literally, they made matches. They were in a factory which made matches. You know, matches that you use when you can't find a lighter. Now, remember, at the time, most people's houses were lit by oil lamps, and the most modern houses had gas. So they sold billions of matches every day. It was a huge industry. And perhaps also you can imagine that the conditions in the factory were dangerous because it's dangerous chemicals, in fact. And in fact, they were very well known. The Match Girls, they were 12, 14 years old, and they always had yellow skin because that was the poison involved. And the old trade unionists didn't imagine that 12-year-old girls could lead the biggest and most powerful strike in the 1880s, but they did, and it became a tremendous cause célèbre, as we say in English, inspired many people, because a lot of workers in other industries said, well, hey, if 12-year-old girls can organise a strike and win, yeah, hey, you know, maybe we could as well. Yeah, and the next huge one is the Dockers strike, and you can see that by this time we have photographs, so that's a photograph of the Dockers strikes. Now, these strikes could be pretty hard, you know, because people had nothing to eat when they were on strike, or the trade union would organise kitchens to feed people, but they had to be very strict. So, you know, you're not a member of the union, you can't eat. You know, they couldn't be. Yeah, yeah, you weren't on strike yesterday, you're not eating today. And they had to be very hard about it. And the trade union leaders at the time were not sitting around in offices. They were at the door organising the food and things like that. Some of the people like Thomas Mann, the great heroes of theirs. So that's just the trade unions. And there I've gone through the trade unions, if you like, from the early trade unions in the 1750s to the late trade unions in 1890. So now I'm going to go back again and look at other forms of resistance, because trade unions were not the only form of resistance. One of the very popular forms of resistance in a society which is not democratic, remember that you can't really say, well, Britain is not fully democratic until 1928, when all adults have the vote. But if you say, let's say it's democratic after, well, let's say a quarter of the population, the adults have the vote. Let's say it's a bit democratic. 1884. Before 1884, there was not even a quarter of the population with the vote. So, you know, that for a long time, you're not talking about democratic society. It's a parliamentary society. Yeah, it's not an absolute monarchy, but it's certainly not a democratic society. And one of the favourite ways of resisting in a non-democratic society is the good old riots. What's that? Oh, that's just the Dockers Union from the 1890s. So you can see that they've it's very full of dreams and it's very important to people. But before that, I'm going right back to 1811, when the main way of resistance is the riot. Yeah, it's the riot. You know, if you throw the tax collector in the river, you know, maybe they won't ask so many taxes. A lot of this work was done by a great historian, Eric Hobsbawm, because the traditional conservative historians for a long time simply stuck to the idea, well, you know, history is what the king and the prime ministers do, and the poor people rioted because they're stupid. And that's the old, for a long, long time, until the 1950s, a lot of history was just like that. Yeah. And Eric Hobsbawm looked at the idea of riot and said, no, actually, the reason that people riot is because it works. Now, it doesn't always work, but it often works. And indeed, this is what he called collective bargaining by riot. La négociation collective par les meutes. And one of the big moments is 1811, and 1811 is the revolt of the Luddites. On en parle encore aujourd'hui des Luddites, et je vais vous dire pourquoi. And the reason they were called Luddites, Luddites. Have you heard of the Luddites before? Raise your hand if you've heard of them. Je ne vais pas vous questionner, ne vous en faites pas. Voilà, merci. Okay, the reason they were called Luddites is because their leader was General Ned Ludd. Now, at the time, and what they did was they broke, they smashed up machines which were replacing their jobs. However, at the time, if you were found smashing up a machine, you were executed. And so, as you can imagine, General Ned Ludd was not the real name of a leader. He was an imaginary leader, General Ned Ludd. And what they used to do is they used to go to the owners of these machines. These were machines which were replacing the work of artisans, and so the artisans had nothing to eat. And so they'd leave a message, get rid of your machine or we will break it, signed General Ned Ludd. Of course, it was a different person who signed in every case. And they, this was a big revolt over a whole section of the Midlands. And so they passed a new law which said you can execute people for breaking machines. And this is a poster from the time. Whereas several evil-minded persons have assembled together in a riotous manner and destroyed a number of frames. These are machines. In different parts of the country. This is to give notice that any person who will give information of any person or persons thus wickedly breaking the frames shall, upon conviction, receive 50 guineas reward. So you get 50 guineas if you denounce a machine breaker. This is a huge amount of money. It's an absolute fortune. You're rich for life. The reward. However, they had very little success. Because the machine breakers were very popular indeed. And here you have a picture of the imaginary leader of the Luddites. And as you can see, he is dressed as a woman, and this is something that they used to do. Of course, when you went to break the machines, you did it in the middle of the night, and all the men dressed as women. So if anybody saw them, it would be a little bit confusing. An example of resistance by rioting. And the last kind of resistance is the fight for democracy, if you like. But this is the fight for democracy in the 19th century, because as I mentioned to you, that the end of the fight for democracy is 1928, when all adults... you might think that... It was all adults over 21, and then later it was all adults over 18. But let's say there was the same treatment for everybody was from 1928. But these were the big moments in the 19th century of this this fight for the right to vote. 1832, and now every single one of these acts was faced enormous resistance among the elites. The 1832 Reform Act, there were riots, there was panic, the House of Lords revolted, and so on and so forth. And yet, nevertheless, today we call this the First Reform Act. But it's very important to remember that in 1832 it was not called the First Reform Act. It was called the Great Reform Act, because the people who passed it were determined it would be the last. It was supposed to stop the pressure for reform, not to begin reforming. And indeed, if I remember correctly, before 1832... Yeah, before 1832... J'ai oublié les chiffres exacts, mais mon impression c'est qu'avant 1832, il y a 3% de la population qui vote, et après il y a 6%. It's that kind of level, yeah. So it certainly does not bring about a democratic society. However, it does involve reforms. The first reform it involves is that the big cities all have members of parliament after the 1832 Reform Act. One of the problems they had before the 1832 Reform Act is there were lots of small villages which had a member of parliament, but Manchester had no members of parliament and Birmingham had no members of parliament. Because it had been fixed centuries ago, and these were the centres of commerce. So the commercial classes were very unhappy with saying there were no members of parliament at all for Manchester and Birmingham. And so after the Reform Act, the big industrial cities got a member of parliament, and some of these small villages. I think the extreme example was there was one village which had like 7 people, and they had a member of parliament. It was some really quite ridiculous things, yeah. I think it's also important to remember that the elites were not just frightened of democracy, also they thought it was a bad idea. They said, well, you know, England, Yeah, the land of the Angles, England. Can you see the word land? Now, you don't have any land, so why should you vote? You know, people who have land vote. That's normal. That's why we call it England. How stupid are you? Yeah, that really was not just resistance to the fact that they felt that they would lose power. It was also a whole ideology. And so there were people in all classes of the population who said, well, no, of course. It's a land, so the people who own the land vote. It's obvious, yeah? So it was very hard to get hold of. Now, the next big moment is the first mass national working class movement in the world is Chartism. Chartism was based, as its name suggests, around the Charter, which had a series of demands. The vote for all adult men, equal constituencies, paid members of parliament. Members of parliament must be paid. This is a crucial democratic demand. Because if members of parliament are not paid, only rich people can be members of parliament, because workers have to work. It sounds bizarre today to think of demanding salary for members of parliament. Being progressive, it was essential. The secret ballots. At this time, until somewhere down here, the people voted in public. Oh, okay, only rich people voted, but also they voted in public, in the pub. And so they didn't dare vote against the Duke. And so the secret ballot was one of the demands of the Chartists. Annual parliaments. An election every year. Now, all of their demands except an election every year will eventually happen. They produced a first enormous Chartist petition, and they took it to London, and the Parliament debated, said, shall we talk about this petition? And a massive majority of the Parliament said, no, we don't want to talk about it. Go away. And so the Chartists, who really had a great, who were a massive movement, were very disappointed. It's also very important to, because today we get a little bit cynical about voting, say, yeah, I suppose I ought to vote, every 5 years, put a cross, why not? But it's not really important. A lot of people think like that. When there was no right to vote, people were convinced that if ordinary people had the right to vote, this would abolish poverty and completely change society. So this is why they formed a mass, radical, excited movement, because they were convinced that voting would transform. How could you have poverty if everybody voted? It's obvious. And we now know that that it doesn't quite work like that. And the Chartists became the first national working class political party. It didn't call itself a political party, but that's what it was in the world. They had many newspapers. They had debates. What's the best way to win the vote for everybody? And they tried different things. They tried a general strike in 1842. In some parts of the country, they organised weapons training, and there was an uprising in Newport, an armed uprising, a couple of years before or a couple of years after, around that time. Of course, they were like 200 people in arms, so they were not successful at all. And they also had the Chartist land plan. Well, so the problem is that in the towns we have such terrible working conditions. Our children are dying all the time. What we need to do is to go back to living in the villages. And so what they did is let everybody give a bit of money, and we will buy some farms, and then we'll have a lottery, and a few people will be able to go and live in farms, and then we'll continue. And little by little, we'll all go back to the farms. Now, it sounds very idealistic and naive, which it probably was, but it really really mobilized people. It was not a great success, because it's just like, imagine what he said, hey, it's so hard work being a student. Let's go back to the farms, and now I've got a farm, and I'll put you four people, you have one, you go to the farm, and of course, you wouldn't be very good, would you? Because this was the problem, the workers actually no longer knew anything about farming, so it didn't really work out. The third Chartist position, so from 1838 to 1848, Chartism was this enormous mass movement with its debates, men Chartist groups and women Chartist groups. At the time, it was socially impossible to have a mixed group, so they had separate groups. After 1848, the third Chartist petition, the Chartist movement declined, and they had not won their demands. And so the question that we were always asked at school, you know, why did the Chartist movement fail? And it's true that they didn't get their demands. On the other hand, the people who were involved in the Chartist movement went on to organise trade unions. The ideas that they put forward in their newspapers inspired the foundation of the Labour Party later on. So you know, they left a heritage. Then 20 years, don't you remember how long these periods are? You know, you have the third part, and then the activists are waiting 19 years before there's any progress. The Second Reform Act meant that many middle-class men will have the vote. So it was much bigger reform than this one. And the Third Reform Act, most working-class men have the vote. Je crois que c'est deux tiers des hommes après 84. This is very interesting because quite rightly we have a lot of we spend a lot of time studying the women's suffrage movement, but the time between two thirds of men getting the vote and two thirds of women getting the vote is 46 years. So for many hundreds of years, neither men nor women had the vote, and then for 46 years. The men had more votes than the women. Not quite, because in 1918, all men got the votes and women over 30. Yeah? So there's certainly those two things going on. Those are the big changes. Now that's the end of a section, and that's the end of a section. So I'm going to stop there because I'm going to leave the empire till next time, and that's the right time to stop. And also, you have to listen very hard because it all goes very fast and it's all very dense. So thank you.